In young life, you think and feel and are confident that you can do anything you want. That's why a new pair of sneakers make you faster. A new haircut makes you more aerodynamic. Because you can, because you're a kid. You don't have limitations. You don't have problems. Not big ones, anyway. You get to about middle age, and you start recognizing your limitations. So when you were a kid, you didn't have compulsive sins and bad habits that held on to you. At least you didn't recognize them as such at that time. But by midlife, you've started to say, you know, I've got some limitations. I never lost a foot race sprinting against other kids when I was a kid. But in midlife, when I was playing some soccer in an intramural league, I started seeing people run past me. I recognized my limits. I got injured. I found out it takes me 3 times longer than it used to heal. You start recognizing that you have limits. You have to lay stuff aside. You start realizing that you have compulsive sins and habits that hold on to you that are not easily broken. You're like, where did these things come from? You start saying, I wanted to be this, but I'm only this, and so why can't I reach that? But then you say, you know what, it's okay. I'm going to be how I am. And then by the time you get to be old age, you take up the mantra that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. You are who you are. You're settled, you're set, and change comes slowly. All of this, our psychologist friends tell us, are matters of willpower. Willpower, when you're little, doesn't mean anything. Like, you have zero willpower, but you have 100% will to do anything you think you ought to be able to do. By the time you get to be old, you know where your willpower is good and where it's not. And so if you're broken, you just continue to be broken. And if you're not broken, then you wish all those other people weren't broken. That's what happens when you get old and move into old age. And the psychologist people say that willpower is a fiction. Our psychologist people tell us that change is always very limited. And today we want to engage in a journey of change because there is a matter of willpower that we need to deal with. As we open the book of James, you can start turning there. If you're unfamiliar, of course, if you have a digital Bible, you can click there. But if you're unfamiliar where it is, if you run past Hebrews, it's the next book. If you hit 1 Peter, you've gone too far. All right, so roll back. James is about 5 chapters, and we're going to hit it in the next 8 or 9 weeks. And he really deals with a lot of hard, heavy commands, things that we as believers in Jesus are supposed to do. He's going to talk to us, and most believers that I know, their issue is not so much about knowing what God would expect of them as it is about actually doing what God would expect of them. Most of us know the right things to do, but carrying it out and having the willpower to stick to the plan, that's the hard part. All of New Year's resolutions are built around some new willpower you're going to have that you never had before, but you're all of a sudden, because it's a new year, you're going to have it. That seemed to be like a recipe for failure. It is, in fact, a recipe for failure. And that's why our New Year's resolutions go by, and as you get older, you set fewer and lower bars for change in your life. So it used to be that you were going to build a new house in the new year. And now it's like, well, I hope to mop the floors at least monthly in the new year. As you get older, right? And you know that's a challenge. I told myself when I got my little puppy, Thomas, that he's going to get a weekly bath. It was easy when he was like this big and you could just scrub him. Now he has a mind of his own. It's harder, and he doesn't get a weekly bath, and Tracy complains to me. And then she tells me that I spoil him. Of course I spoil him. I loved it. He's a dog of my old age. The letter from James, as we began to kind of dig in on this, today, in fact, we're going to cover really what is the preface and the whole guiding theme of the book of James. This letter that I'll call him Pastor James. Maybe he was an apostle, but he wasn't an apostle of the Lord Jesus. He was a pastor, as best we can tell, of the Jerusalem church. And he has a very different approach in the way he commands things, but he gives us a whole lot of understanding about what God expects. However, he's also super easy to misread. If you read James as a collection of commands, there's about 50 hard commands in James in 5 chapters. That's not very many verses. There's about 50 hard commands, and he can be incredibly overwhelming. And it is overwhelming for us to think about putting our life in line with what God wants when we lack the power to do it. I want us to realize today that James talks about a personage, not a collection of commands, but a personage. We're going to call that personage a disciple. See, some of us believe, and this is a part of our problem in the change that needs to happen in our life, some of us believe that we are converts, that is, we have made mental assent to some things that God has spoken, rather than being reborn. Some of us think about the fact that we made a decision to trust Christ, but then our lives are left to languish in old behaviors and in broken ways. The death, for those who have trusted in Jesus, the death you experience is the death you brought with you. Resurrection comes from Christ, and so what Christ should be doing in our lives is transforming us. But he doesn't transform just behaviors. He transforms our personage. And so James talks to the personage, the transformed person who has trusted in Jesus. And this personage, the disciple, it describes who we grow into. My dog will never become a human ever, right? If you're a believer in Jesus, you're not just a convert, somebody who has agreed to some factors about Jesus. You have been reborn spiritually. You are a new creation. Behold, the old is gone, the new has come. What does that even mean when we continue to struggle against sin in our lives? Does it mean that if I'm not perfect, then I wasn't saved? Well, I tell you what, there's no New Testament if that was the thought. The New Testament is coaching in godliness, but you have to first decide that change is important, that change becomes your personage. You see, a disciple acts in certain ways and has certain attitudes and picks up certain appetites. And when you have been transformed from the ways of the world and been brought into the new kingdom of Christ, you're going to begin to feel some problems that you didn't have before. You see, it's tough. It's really tough to live as a believer when the whole world is a non-believer. And so notice how he starts. Let's pick up our text here. See, today, I want us to be able to map out the change we need to make because we are disciples. Not just a collection of peripheral changes, but the core of who we are. And you have to start by saying, okay, I've trusted Jesus. I am a new creation that is called a disciple. A disciple is a follower, fundamentally, a follower of Jesus. I do the things, I think the thoughts, I have the appetites that Jesus has. And so when you begin to look at yourself that way, you say, what do disciples do? How do disciples think? What kind of appetites do disciples have? If I'm about to drink this alcohol, is this something that a disciple would participate in? If I'm about to eat that extra portion, is that something the disciple would do? If I have this gossipy attitude and this hard heart towards somebody, is that something a disciple would have? And so today we're going to be able to map out the change we need and that we need to make because of who we have been remade into. a resurrected life that's headed toward victory rather than decaying toward defeat. So James 1, chapter 1, verse 1, James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. Super simple introduction of who he is. He doesn't go into it. He just tells us who he is. And notice, this is critical for us to understand the whole book. To the 12 tribes in the dispersion, greetings. The dispersion had a whole Jewish context. The shorthand of it is this. You as believers are out of sync with the world. You don't belong in it. And that's what he's pointing out. You're trying to live as a disciple when the rest of the world is beastly. You're trying to live civilized in Jesus when the rest of the world is ruthless and without God. He says, verse 2, count it all joy, my brethren, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. I told you, he comes at us, right? Like, he just off the bat comes at us. And he tells us to do something that is near impossible. Verse 2, he says, listen, you are in the dispersion. You're disciples of the Lord Jesus. You belong to him, but you live in a context. You see, disciples are out of sync with the world. You have to grab hold of that reality. You're out of sync with the world. I remember as a kid watching Mrs. Doubtfire. You remember this show? It didn't seem so bad. We started it as adults to watch it, and I was like, holy smokes. I would never let my kids watch this. I don't think my parents let me watch it. I think I found a way to watch it. You know, that kind of movie? Goonies was the same way. Back to the Future is kind of the same way. Like, you watch these shows, and you're like, man, this is really out of sync in a lot of ways. And listen, the more you follow Jesus, the more as a disciple you live out what it means to be a disciple, the more out of sync you're going to find your world. But you don't get saved and then caught up to heaven immediately. You get saved in Jesus, and you're called to be an ambassador within a world that is opposed to the message. They're not just openly opposed to the message. They're also passively opposed to the message, passively opposed to the authority of Christ. And there are two commitments we come to. We can decide that even though we're out of sync with our world, because we're disciples of Jesus, we can decide that we will work on our lives anyway, or we can decide to just give into it and go along with it anyway. There are two commitments that we make in our life based on the fact that we're disciples and we're out of sync with the world. We can either say, look, it's not that bad, we'll just go along with it. And this affects our use of time and our use of money and our use of relationships and our use of work. Or we can decide today that we will map out change so that we will work on who we are and the way we live anyway. Now, look, a lot of us think then, if we decide to work on the parts of our life that are out of sync with God, that we'll never get it done because many have tried and many have failed. I want you to know, if you trust Jesus today, your life will be harder tomorrow than it was when you started out today. When you trust Jesus, it puts you out of sync with the world. You think about it this way. The world is all headed toward death and then hell. That's the scripture that lays that out for us. That's a morbid, hard, difficult end game, right? But those who are believers, who are disciples in Jesus, are headed toward a physical death and spiritual life forevermore. That is fundamentally different. That's a different investment. If somebody said, listen, I'm going to give you $1 million And I want you to invest it. You know what you're going to do? You're going to pick winners to invest your $1 million in. You're going to pick winners based on how long you expect those companies to exist and how profitable you expect them to be. And you'll give that $1 million and you'll expect your dividends and your payouts because they're good companies, because they will win. But with our personal lives, we don't tend to invest that way. You realize that the great vices in our day expend exorbitant resource of time and money to accomplish. Listen, if alcohol or smoking or one of these vices in the world has a hold on you, I want you to know what it's going to do. It's going to take more of your money than anything else, and it's going to take more of your time than anything else, and it's going to become the center of your life like nothing else. And it leads to death. That's the only place it goes. If you have trusted in Jesus, you say, I'm a disciple. You're going to feel out of sync with the world because you are headed toward victory rather than toward defeat. And guys, that's the beautiful message of the gospel of Jesus, that our sin need not destroy us, but through Jesus, we can be rescued from it. So it makes sense, verse 2, what he says. He says, count it all joy, my brethren, when you meet trials of various kinds. This trials of various kinds, many colored trials, literally in the Greek, many colored trials. This is all kinds of trials, every kind of trial, not just the trials you create for yourself because you made a bad decision, but the trials that come upon you because life can be difficult, because there's financial downturn in the market, because you have failed and sin has consequences, because you've done the right thing and that is out of sync with the world and you have to having to pay those consequences, because your company went broke and you've been kicked out of work, like whatever kind of trial. And he says, how do I look at my trials? Well, I count them joy. You see why you have to decide. You have to make this commitment that regardless of your situation, regardless of your trials, you are going to work on what it means to be a disciple. You have to decide that. You have to look at the problems, the places that are out of sync with Christ, that are in line with the world, and you have to say, I need to change those things. And if you don't make that decision, then you can't count as joy the trials that you meet. It's a prohibitive feature. If you can't decide that change is inbound because you are a disciple, then you can't count your trials as joy. Most of us want joy, right? Rather than despair. Anybody signing up in the despair line? Nobody goes and shops for despair. Despair finds us, but we may go shopping for joy. And some of us spent way too much on Christmas looking for joy that way. There's a lot of ways in which we look for joy. But listen, if you choose to work on it, if you choose that commitment, the disciple behavior, then I want to tell you, the media you see isn't right. You're going to feel out of sync with it. And as you age, you'll begin to have some wisdom about it. You'll realize that it never will be right. Listen, parenting as a disciple is different than parenting without the Lord. You are charged as a disciple of Jesus to create, to make disciples. And that begins with your children in your home. So it's going to mean they don't get to do some of the things that their friends do, and that they're going to have to spend their Sunday mornings at church and all of that kind of stuff. And you're like, well, kids always want to go to church, so this isn't a problem. Are you kidding? Some kids love to go to church because the snacks are good. Others because the playground's cool. And most because their parents made them go. It is acceptable, parents, while your kids are under your roof, to demand their attendance. That is acceptable and right in the Lord. You see, you're going to have to look out there and you're going to have to say, look, I feel like the media isn't right. You're going to have to look out there. You're going to have to realize that the joy of life isn't complete. You see, you're out of sync with the world, so there's always going to be these challenges to your life, things that are out of sync with you. And you begin to realize that it never will be just right. Your commitment to be a disciple means that there's always some antagonism between you and the world around you. You can't ever quite fit in. That's like exactly contrary to what we want to hear, right? We want to hear that through Jesus, everything's going to like ease off and be fine. And then James comes at us with this and says, in fact, count it all joy, whatever your trials. Implying what? You'll have trials. Since you'll have trials, here's how you think about them. So if you choose to work on your life, if you choose to change and pick up disciple behaviors and thoughts and appetites, then you're going to find that out of sync component all around you, and it's going to become more obvious. How then do I count it joy? Well, in fact, what he tells us is that disciples find joy in their steadfastness, not in their outcomes. Our world plays for outcomes. You're a successful company not because you do good, but because you make money. You're a successful businessman or a successful employee because you got a promotion, not because you followed Christ in it. The world rewards outcomes. You might have a cheating team that gets the trophy, but you know what? They got the trophy. They get the honor. They get the acknowledgement. Some people, you can think about it this way, some people love working out. We should all love working out. I love losing weight. I don't love working out. Some of you are weird, and just the fact of working out makes you happy. The fact of working out makes me unhappy. Now, if I were a healthy person, then I would love working out. That is a behavior of a healthy person, to work out. But because I'm not a healthy person, I simply love the outcomes, and so I trudge off to my duty of working out. You catch the difference? You see, we find joy in steadfastness. Disciples find joy in steadfastness, not outcomes. You have to love the right things. You see, if I loved working out, then the result, the outcome would be being in shape, right? And it would be easy. I'd be like, man, today I get to work out. I never once have thought that. Some of you have thought that. You're like, well, I go to work today, but I'll get to work out. Good on you. But notice what he says. When you meet these trials of various kind, you know the outcome. You know what that means. You can't count it joy because you're going to meet trials. He's not a masochist where he says, enjoy your pain. He's saying, you enjoy what you get. And the outcome of counting your trials as joy is a steadfast faith. Endurance, durability. You catch what he lays out here for us. It says, so you don't have to love the out-of-sync problems that you run into because you are a disciple of Jesus. You don't have to be in love with your pain. You don't need to be in love with your pain. You don't have to even love change in your life. But you do have to love the steadfastness that it produces. You want to be a strong disciple of Jesus? If you want to be a faithful, steadfast follower of Jesus, the key that he lays out here is that you count joy your trials, meaning you know that your trials matter to God and they matter in his formative work in your life. You have to endure. Disciples endure. It's one of their qualities. You know, the insect that I think is the most enduring insect in the world that I know of, you know what it is? A dung beetle. Dung beetles are committed little gross insects, aren't they? They make their balls, they push them across the barren desert, they go find an, they're in the desert. I mean, there's not a lot of things in the desert, which means there's not a lot of stuff they get to roll. They got to go find it, and then they endure to get it where it needs to go. Dung beetles are durable creatures. They were created to be because they got a tough job. Listen, folks, you got to endure, and sometimes it's like being a dung beetle. You don't much love what you're enduring through, but you got to push it. The reality of life and a disciple's life is endurance, 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 steadfastness. And you have to find joy in that steadfastness. You have to be able to look back and say, I once was there, but God has changed me. And how did he change me? Well, it wasn't easy, but he put you through the trial and the difficulty and the trouble, and you've come out on the other side as stronger and wiser. So you have to choose this joy. This joy is how you has to do with how you think about your trials. Stepped on an ant pile the other day, and none of those ants looked up and was like, curse you, boot! Not a single one of them stopped and cursed the boot. They just went out ready for two things, to fight and to rebuild. They didn't even think about it. You ever step on a fire ant pile? That's the two things on their mind. Fight, whatever happens to be there, we're going to take you on, take you down, all million of us, or build. That's the options. And folks, so it is with us. When you choose joy, you can't complain. You can't say, well, these trials, throw up my hands. When you got a two-year-old, this is often the condition of your house. Tempting just to throw up your hands because two-year-olds love to pull every toy out of the box except for the one that they're going to play with. They hide that somewhere unknown to any human. And then they go look for it, not because they don't know where they hid the toy they want to play with, but just because moms, they love to torture you. That's how it happens. You have to choose the joy in your trials. Sometimes as parents, we throw up our hands and we're like, I don't know what to do about these children. Sometimes as spouses, we throw up our hands. I don't know what to do about this, my marriage partner. Sometimes as employees, as business owners, as students, we throw up our hands. We don't know what to do. And I tell you, if you don't know what else to do, then you endure. God doesn't lead us to any dead ends, but he does lead us to places where you have to endure. And when you have to endure, you say, this is for my benefit. I can have joy in this. You don't have to love working out to get the outcomes of that. And you find joy that's the outcome that you're looking for, is that steadfastness. And counting your trials as joy is the key to steadfastness. That means that life is going to deal you a lot of curveballs because you're out of sync with it. And if you get discouraged about your trials, remember something we've talked about before, but I think it's very important. He uses the word trials here, which depending on how you work this word could mean trials or temptations. Trials are external things that come at us. Temptations are internal things that distort us. These are trials. These are external things that come at you. Some of us then, we're like, well, my problems are within. My problems are temptations. What do I do about that? He says steadfastness, that is your durability to stay with Christ. Remember, you're a disciple. That means you, by new birth, follow Jesus. When the world turns south, you are going to turn north into the new kingdom. Remember, You don't get an option here. You've trusted Jesus. You will end in the eternal kingdom. You are a disciple in that sense that you must follow, you've committed, and you will get there. He says then, okay, what do I do if my problems are internal to me? Well, let's take it apart. He says, let steadfastness have its full effect. And what does it produce? It produces perfection and completion. So in every other way that you can control in your life, the right choice is to count joy as God creates steadfastness. And what God will do over time is cure the temptation within, and he will use the trial without to accomplish that. You see, sometimes this is why when we get to a really low place, we cry out to God and it changes everything. Because we've had enough of the beat down that temptation and the expression and the living in sin produces. And we finally say, Lord, okay, the trial has beat you down and has made you ready for change. Guys, most of us, and this is a rule for parenting, most of us require a good bit of softening up before we're ready to make change. We have to be punished quite often before we're ready to commit to heart change. I wish it were not so, but many of us learn more from the rod than we do from the instructor. That's just how life is, how stubborn humans are, and some of us are more stubborn than others. See, and he lays out verse 5 then. If any of you lacks wisdom. See, here's the thing, right? It's hard to know where I'm at in life, where I need to start. If I were to lay out all my problems, how would I know wherever to begin to change? What would I know came first in this whole list of things? So he gives us the key to the rest of the book of James. Now listen, James is difficult not because it's unclear what he means, but because I think he uses what he's going to say in verses 5 through 8 as the governing principle for how we determine the rest of what God will do. For instance, does God have to heal you if you call the elders of the church together to pray over you and anoint you with oil? That's what he says in chapter 5. He says, is any of you sick? Let him call the elders of the church together. They will anoint him with oil and pray for him, and the prayer of faith will heal him. Does that mean that every time you're sick, you call me and some of the guys of the church, and we come over and pour oil on you and pray for your sickness to go away, and you get healed? I can tell you 100% that does not happen every time. Some people got to die, right? People have to die. That's a part of it. So how do I know when to pray? Ah, verse 5. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God. You see, disciples think more like God thinks. Disciples think more like God thinks. Over time, they think more like God thinks. Disciples, at the beginning of new birth, have very infantile understandings of what God does and the kind of thoughts God has. But as we grow in our steadfastness, we begin to learn the longhand way in which God has worked. Our minds begin to change and our thought patterns become more mimicking of God's thought patterns. The neurons of the maturing mind create new ways of thinking because of the demands of the environment and because of practice. If you want to get good at something, when I used to be in contracting, it feels like another life, I could remember 4 or 5 or 6 measurements all at one time. Like I could keep them in my head and I could make all of those because daily I knew these measurements on my tape measure. 54 and 5/8, 33 and 7/8, you know, and I could remember those 5 or 6 of them and could get them accurate and just cut the boards that I needed. I've been working on my house and I can remember maybe 1 measurement after I walk out of the room and not have to go back and measure it again. Why? Because my brain has not been working in these ways, and so I don't have the demand function, and I've lost that ability to that was measured over time. Now, Scripture, I can remember. I know places and locations of verses, and because I've been in it, right? My mind has changed. And so disciples' minds change. And so he says, if you lack wisdom, what do you need to do to get it? And so James oddly seems very distant from God at times, but herein, he's very intimate with God. He says, wisdom is for the asking. Are you confused about what you need to do, about what change needs to happen? I mean, what really would produce steadfastness that you could have joy in? Then you ask God for wisdom. And here's what he says. He says, God gives that generously. Not just a little bit, but a lot of it. He gives to any, and he doesn't even say, guys, I know. It's always a thing. I feel like, honey, when did you say we're going to do that? Guys, am I right? It's always a thing. It's like a risk. You don't know if when you ask that, that's something you should innately know. Honey, when are we doing that again? Now, if it's a date or whatever, like you're going on a date with your wife and you're like, were we going on Thursday or Friday? You're going to be in trouble for that. That's how it is. You have to be reproached a little bit. If you forget your anniversary, fellas, look, most of us have handheld devices that have calendars on them. I no excuse, but if you forget it, you're going to be reproached. If you ask when it is, you're going to be reproached. So here's the thing. If you forgot a birthday or you forgot, like, anniversary, go ahead and ask one time, mark it down, put it on a repeat on your calendar. That way you don't have to be reproached again next year when it comes back around. It's going to come in 365 days every year. And so get the reproach out of the way. When's your birthday, honey? I can't remember. You're gonna be reproached. But even though you should know it, God doesn't reproach you. He's better than your wife. No, that's a theologically true statement. I mean, when you put it that way, it sounds kind of rough, but just saying. If you ask him, if you ask God, he gives generously. Meaning, he doesn't just stingy. He's not stingy with his wisdom where he just gives you enough. He's like, do something with that wisdom. He says, in fact, here you go. My kids used to get so frustrated. They would ask a question. Dad, what does this mean in the Bible? And, oh, man, that's like catnip for me. We're like, well, then I would answer with a question. I'm like, well, what do you think about this? And what do you think about that? My kids are like, Dad, could you just answer the question? I was giving generously of the wisdom that I had. My kids wanted an answer, and I wanted them to learn something. Listen, when God gives generously, there's something of this effect going on. When you ask for wisdom, you anticipate and expect a generous portion of wisdom. And notice the imperative here, the functional. It will be given him. This is a perfect, it will be given, the idea of it is accurate in the past and it will continue to be so in the future. God will work to answer that question. He will over answer that question. He will give you an abundant portion of wisdom, and he will do it every time. One caveat, verse 6. But when he asks, let him ask in faith, without doubting. Without doubting. For the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea. It's an interesting component. Here's two ways in which he might mean, and I kind of think he refers to both, in which he might mean we're doubting. Number one way, we're doubting maybe that God will give wisdom. That's one way we might doubt. Or number two way we might doubt is the wisdom we actually get. In other words, God gives us the answer, and we say, I don't really think that's going to work. I mean, God, I know my circumstance. I know how my boss is. And I don't really think that course of action is going to work out. That would be doubting. And that would be rather foolish to tell God he doesn't know what he's talking about, right? And yet, when you're living out of sync with your world as a disciple, it would be common for us to get answers that we don't expect and that we see no hope of accomplishing. You know, the Lord can turn fortunes around overnight. God doesn't require a big run-up to accomplish his plans. He has immense power, all power, to do whatever he desires. But usually, long before we've asked, God has already been working toward wherever you are to take you wherever he wants you to be. Remember, God is more invested in your perfection and your completion. We're going to call it maturity. God is more invested in your maturity than you are. Just as you, parents, are more invested in your kids' maturity than they are. Your kids don't know they need to be mature, but you know it. And sometimes as disciples of the Lord Jesus, we don't know we need to be mature, but God knows it. And so he's given us these situations. He's made available to us wisdom, and he causes us to begin to think more like he thinks. Think about neuroplasticity, thinking the thoughts of God. It doesn't happen overnight. There are no five easy steps to a mind like God's. And it's interesting then that it's within the trial that you're asking for this wisdom. See, sometimes we don't know exactly what we need until we get in the place where we have that need. You don't think God engineers that part of your life as well? The hardship, the difficulty, the trouble, the trauma of life. You don't think he's able to deliver you, to give you wisdom, to make your selections, your choices, your foot forward? Listen, you may come to a place and you say, I need real change in my life today. That's what I need. And you know what? It's because God has got you there. And you say, Lord, how do I make this change? That's a request for wisdom. And God then begins to answer. So how do we think more like God thinks? He tells us we ask for wisdom. Number two, it seems we wait for God to give it. Number three, we're expecting a generous portion. Listen, not a yes or no, but an answer. This has revolutionized the way that I've prayed, honestly. This passage has revolutionized the way that I prayed, because what I found in my prayers is I was usually asking God to do specific things, and then kind of unattached was my wisdom, unattached from the prayer request was my wisdom about how God would get it done. And I want to tell you something. If you ask God for wisdom, you have to decide that God's method is his wisdom for getting it done. So I want to ask for things without then setting my expectations for how God has to do it. God, I need a new car. You know my car is in bad shape. And particularly, I want a Ferrari, but you know, a Chevy will be okay too. And I need it by such and such a date. Very practically, you can know the date and you can know that you need a car. Is that legit? Absolutely, it's legit. I'm asking God, how do I pray for this? What do I say? And every 40 days, I ask God for my new prayers. I'm asking God to tell me how to think like him. And so I ask him, and I expect a generous portion. Expecting a generous portion means that God is also going to build my steadfastness as he answers that prayer. So he's not just going to do it for me, but he's also going to transform me in the process. That's how change happens. Not just seeing the answer to your prayers, but being transformed by the answer itself. You see, following God is not an easy task, but it's an incredible thing. It's a beautiful thing. Some of us are asking, saying, God, help my kid's anxiety. Help my kid to know Jesus. Help my kid to return. Help my kids to be in church. Help my spouse to love me more. Help me to love them more. Lord, help me to forgive my coworker or my parents. We're asking hard things. And we're asking these hard things and we're saying, Lord, how do we do it? And it may be that God, in his generous wisdom, causes you to do something you would never expect doing. Change, when you ask God for it, you have to expect a generous portion. And then when God leans on you and you know what you need to do, you do it. Because in James, faith and action go together. You can't say, I believe God, without doing what God says to be done. And he lays it out for us, and he says, you believe what God says. You act on God's wisdom, not just waiting, but jumping. If God says jump, you jump. If God says wait, you wait. If God says go, you go, right? And then you judge the decisions. Look at your life for a moment. Think about your life and where it's at. Let me ask you, are you there? Are you there because of bad decisions? The answer is probably, in some cases, probably yes. Yeah, I made some bad decisions and I'm here. However, some of us, we would say, I'm in this predicament because of other people's decisions and I just had bad outcomes. Sometimes we're at fault and sometimes we're not. Listen, when God moves, he may move in such a way that it creates more trials for you. And then you say, well, it didn't work. And I did what God said, but it made the situation worse. Yeah, that might happen. This is why James is tough. Because he says, your joy comes from knowing that steadfastness is what will grow. He warns us, right? He says, if you ask and doubt, you're like, second part of verse 6, you're like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. If you ask and doubt, then that doubt will drive you along. It will push you around. Most of us don't change because we do doubt. Not because God is unfaithful or unable, but because we doubt. We dodge God's work. And so the world has its impact on us, and the world is what's the driving agent of our change. Look at your life, the troubles that you're in. Are they not driven along by the world? If you're caught in a vice, in a compulsive sin, listen, it's because the world has pushed you to it. So if you want change, you have to do something different than that. You have to find a different mindset altogether. And you have to value then maturity more than your circumstances. You have to say, listen, what I want God to do in me is make me perfect and complete, to make me grow up and be mature. That word perfect there in verse 4, the second half. Listen, I don't think he's talking about moral perfection or perfectionism. I think that's a false hope. He's talking about a life that is mature in Jesus. That's regular, normative, where Jesus is not just an inserted component, but he is the purpose of our life. Our ability to hear him is tuned and all of that. Not that we don't make mistakes or don't fall into sin, but that we have the basic equipment and the knowledge to fix when we fall into sin. So let's wrap this up because I'm way over time. This is a big passage. And it's a life-changing passage. So, how does your change need to begin? I can tell you, the first step is going to be to ask the Lord for wisdom. Because in finding wisdom, you'll know how to count your trials as joy. You'll know how to look at your trials. And listen, guys, I don't care if you created your problems or if others created your problems. If you're at fault and guilt is there, or if it's somebody else's fault. When you get in the pickle, you need wisdom from God for the change. So, how does your change need to begin? This is a good time, a good Sunday to say to God, this is what needs to be changed in my life. And then you ask the Lord for wisdom, and you let the Lord unfold this. Maybe the concern in your heart right now is for someone else. So who else needs wisdom in their change? See, there's two questions that we have today that we need answers. The first one is what change needs to begin in your life. And the second one is, who else needs this? Who else needs to join you on this journey of change? You may be like, I don't know what to do about my spouse. I don't know what to do about my kids. I don't know what to do about my parents. I don't know what to do about my siblings. I just don't know what to do with them. And they are creating such chaos in my life. How, Lord, do they change? And maybe that's what you need to ask the Lord about. Those are your two questions this morning. In just a moment, the team's going to return. Will you stand with me?